So this morning in the in the instructions, Greg mentioned the fourth satipatthana, mindfulness of dhammas. And the word dhamma has several meanings. When it's written with a capital D, it means the teachings of the Buddha Dhamma. But it can also mean with a small d, it can also mean the truth, the laws of nature, or the phenomena of the world. And in this fourth satipatthana, the Buddha gives some examples of phenomena that we can recognize and contemplate in our practice. It's sort of a way where we can see how our own experience is mirrored in the teachings. It's a sort of way of verify your own experiences and see that it's something that meditators have experienced all these time since the Buddha's time. So it's a Dhamma practice and Dhamma theory is sort of coming together in this fourth satipatthana. So I already mentioned one of the lists that is in this fourth satipatthana, and that's the five hindrances. And then there are several other lists, the Four Noble Truths, for example, and some other ones that we haven't talked about. But then there's one called the Seven Awakening Factors, or the Factors of Enlightenment, is what they are called. So that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. And this is one of the most important parts of the Buddha's teaching, because it shows us what qualities we develop in the mind when we practice this form of meditation. And it's not any sort of abstract or unattainable qualities. We already have them. But we can develop and strengthen them. And then it has a really deep and important impact on our lives and on our practice, on our relationship with ourselves and others. And this development of these factors actually just happens by itself. It's nothing that you sort of have to worry about. When you practice, these factors will develop by themselves, and all we really have to do is to be aware of them, to see them, to feel them, and to recognize them. And the reason that they are called awakening factors is that it's said that when these qualities are developed to a certain extent and in balance with each other, we can actually get enlightened. So these seven factors are divided into two groups. So there are three sort of more energetic and uplifting, enlivening factors. And that's investigation, effort, and joy. And then there are three more stabilizing and calming factors, which are calm, concentration, and equanimity. But first of all the factors comes mindfulness, because mindfulness is the sort of starting point. It develops and balances all the other factors. And we have already talked quite a bit about mindfulness, or awareness, in this retreat, but I will mention a few more things about it. it's called sati in Pali. So sati is the word that is translated as mindfulness nowadays. And mindfulness means to be present in the moment, to directly observe what happens in the mind, the body, and also the close environment. So it means to be awake and not, as we very often do, we go on automatic pilot or doing things while we're actually far away in our worlds of thoughts. So there is also another aspect of this kind of presence of mind that we can apply in meditation, which I have also mentioned before. It's one of those attitudes. So it's to remain quite neutral of what we are experiencing, not to judge it, like this non-judging attitude, and not judge or condemn ourselves or others, but to try to see things with fresh eyes, almost as we were kids and saw them for the first time. So if we are fully present and open in this way, our everyday experience also becomes much more interesting than if we go through life half asleep. Then it gets more dull. So mindfulness has these three functions in our daily life. And the first is what I already said, to clearly see what's happening in the present. Because with this attention, this awareness, we can begin to discover what it is that moves us, that makes our bodies move and our mind move. And we can also see how we identify with our thoughts and emotions and what that leads to. So that is sort of this, the function of mindfulness in meditation. The second function is that it balances the mind. When we're trying to observe what is happening without constantly reacting, the mind becomes calmer and settles down and becomes more balanced. So when we really understand some of these reaction patterns that we may have, for example, just if we identify ourselves with fear, for example, it can really limit our lives, what we dare to do, you know. We can, different fears people have, fears of flying, fear of the dark or whatever, which limits our life. And when we see this and understand it, we can begin to free ourselves from these boundaries and live in a wiser and more balanced way. And the third function of mindfulness, and maybe the one of the most important ones, is that mindfulness starts the whole process of developing all the other factors of enlightenment. So when we are fully aware of the present moment, we start to experience life in a much more dynamic way. We become more aware of all this intricate play of impressions, movements, emotions and reactions that constantly going on, and that sometimes we miss because we're lost in our daydreams. So we get to know ourselves more deeply than before, and this is the actual one of the purposes of Vipassana meditation, to get insights in how our things function in our life, to see things as they really are. Because it's through this understanding one becomes enlightened, not through some interesting or far-out experiences, some altered states of consciousness and or trances, and you know, these can be interesting things to experience, but they are not awakening. Because the Buddha says that for anyone who wants to become enlightened, it's necessary to develop mindfulness. So that's the first factor. And then the second factor of enlightenment is investigation. In Pali it's called the Dhamma Vichaya. So investigation of the Dhamma, actually. And investigation is an attitude of curiosity and willingness to explore. Because sometimes meditation practice can feel a little routine, and we don't really feel committed. We don't look really deeply. We stay at some sort of comfortable level of relaxation and maybe some tranquility, or maybe even just daydreams. And then we need to remember this factor of investigation in order to advance. And investigation in this case is not something intellectual. It's not something we think about or philosophize about. It's more by direct and intuitive experience and observation of the body and mind. So on the physical level, one can, for example, closely examine exactly how it feels when you breathe. The subtle vibrations at the nostrils when the air enters, or when the abdomen rises and falls. If you really are very observant, you can feel all kinds of small sensations of movement, of clothes touching your skin, tension, pressure, heat, whatever. And that this is how you sharpen your concentration and start seeing things that you don't usually pay any attention to. Or when you do the walking meditation, if you sometimes walk really, really, really slowly and for a short period of time at least, and observe every little sensation there is, then that's also this investigation factor. And also the mind, to be aware, not only be aware of something, but to be aware that you are aware of something. That's sort of a step further when you start to be aware of awareness itself. Because we can actually explore moment by moment of this mental activity. How the mind recognizes an object and sees the object change or disappear, sees the whole process. And we can also see how different mental thought patterns are repeated and how they affect us. So meditation is a science of the mind, and investigation is really important in all sciences, all disciplines. You need this investigation to find out how things work. So the third factor is effort or energy. It's called virya in Pali, and in older translations it's sometimes translated as striving, but nowadays we don't sort of we think that striving feels a bit too strong and sort of forward, leaning forward to strive for something. And effort in this kind of meditation in Vipassana is not really striving in that way. It's more, it means more to have an intention and willingness, motivation to pay attention here and now. So you sort of stay in the present moment. You're not striving after something in the future. And it doesn't mean either that we need to change what we experience or to improve ourselves, work on ourselves. It's enough to just simply observe what is really happening without any illusions or self-deceptions. But based on this present moment's experience, we can also train and develop the useful and beneficial states of mind. If, for example, if we see that there is a generous thought in the mind, we can decide to act on it instead of sort of thinking, oh, maybe I need that thing myself later, or, you know. So, and also, like we have been doing here every day, practicing the Brahma Viharas, Metta, and the other ones, that's also a way of develop these states of mind. And we can also train ourselves to avoid becoming too involved in unwholesome states of mind within us. You might find that you have a lot of anger or rage in your mind, and maybe caused by something that somebody did or some memory that comes up or something. And instead of thinking about how you can retaliate, what your sweet revenge is going to be, you can just realize that this, if these actions will just lead to more suffering for everybody, so then, and then this wisdom is to drop this entire revenge project and leave it. So this is a way of developing a skill to avoid getting too involved in unwholesome states of mind. And it's important to know that one shouldn't perceive this advice as a condemnation of ourselves when we happen to be involved in these angry or unwholesome thoughts and mind states. Because in Buddhism it's said that thoughts very often come uninvited. It's not anyone's fault that they can't come. Also, very advanced spiritual people, meditators, can have bad thoughts. The only difference from, as it says in the scriptures, the untrained worldling is the ability to quickly become aware of these unwholesome thoughts and let them disappear back into nothingness, without letting them lead to any unwholesome action, which maybe an untrained worldling would do without having the space to think about the consequences. So another aspect of this effort factor is courage. And we need courage in order to explore all these different mind states and all these nooks and crannies of our minds. Because As our meditation practice deepens, it's not at all sure that it's only happiness we will see. There may be stages in the practice that are painful and difficult. So mind states like doubt, despair, and fear are emotions that we also need to explore, as well as happiness and serenity. So as one teacher said, you can't understand dukkha, life's dissatisfaction and suffering, if you don't first get to know it properly. Because dukkha is not just a theory, it's a real thing. And John of the Cross, a Christian mystic, he speaks in a book he wrote about the dark night of the soul. And that's a stage that somehow the seeker has to go through before they can meet God in the Christian context. And there is also a similar concept in Buddhist practice. And so that's why it's necessary to have courage and perseverance to follow this path. You have to open up for both great happiness and deep pain sometimes. So this investigation and effort are two factors that always support each other. Because an initial effort is always needed to begin to examine in an active and in-depth way. But when you apply proper effort, the meditation also gets very interesting, and interest produces more energy. So it's sort of a positive feedback loop, or what they call it, with this investigation and effort supporting each other. So the fourth of the factors is joy, piti. So after all this talk about suffering and dark night of the soul and all this, we can think that meditation is a sort of very gloomy undertaking. But luckily it's not that all the time. But this fourth factor of enlightenment is joy, rapture, delight, even ecstasy. And joy is called piti in Pali. And this joy can take many different forms and manifest itself in many different ways. It can be anything from a sort of mild feeling of content with how life is right now, and it can be very strong energetic releases and profound happiness, and you know, sometimes it can be so strong that it's almost unpleasant even. It's pleasant but so strong that you wonder if you're gonna survive or if you're gonna explode or something. So it can be many different things. And so another word that describes piti is to be more light-hearted, not to take things so terribly serious all the time. Sometimes we tend to get overwhelmed by our personal problems, and we totally identified with them, these dramas that seem very solid and important. And that's when we need this quality of lightness and humor to get some perspective and realize that everything passes, everything's impermanent, everything changes. No mind state will last forever, even if it sometimes feels like it would. And another way that piti shows itself is when we achieve deeper states of concentration in meditation. then we can also get these chills or shaking or thrills of pleasure to the body and goosebumps and tingles and all kinds of nice sensations, and you can see visions of light or color and inside behind your closed eyes. And sometimes the body can feel really light and almost like you're floating in space or levitating or something, and these states can feel really good, and the time passes quickly in the meditation. Because this kind of joy that is developed through meditation is different from the joy you experience in worldly life. Because its cause is that the mind is collected and focused on the present moment. And that moment is also free from the five hindrances, from desire, hatred, tiredness, restlessness, and doubt. So, and a mind free from that is usually a very happy mind. But there's also a danger with these pleasant experiences. Sometimes there is a stage in meditation, sometimes called pseudo-nirvana, nibbana, when people have a lot of really great PT experiences, and then some meditators think that they are already enlightened, but that's usually not the case, which shows when people stop meditating and they fall back into previous not so pleasant stages. So you also have to look at these exciting and enjoyable and remarkable experiences with distance and humor, and not get identified with them. But certainly PT is a bonus in practice and in life itself also. To be more light-hearted, it makes life brighter and nicer. And it makes it easier to put up with all these annoyances that are inevitably associated with being born as a human being, unfortunately. So, the fifth of the factor is calm, and it's in Pali it's called pasadi. And this is the first of these stabilizing factors that I was talking about. The other ones were the more uplifting and enlivening factors. But this first stabilizing factor is calm. Can it feel at peace or tranquility? And to feel calm and serene, that's also a very pleasant mind state. And because the body and mind is so connected to each other, we can sometimes, as is said in the Satipatthana Sutta, we can help to calm the mind by calming the body. For example, to sit very still when we meditate helps calming the mind, and to use the breathing to calm the mind when you're agitated or anxious. Some deep breath can usually help to bring about more calm. And a really great calm may appear when we drop our efforts to control and manage everything. Many of us are so-called control freaks. We want to have control of everything. But when we accept that others may have different ways of doing things, and none of us are always perfect, and it's very exhausting to be irritated about all these little things that can disturb us. So Thich Nhat Hanh, this Vietnamese Zen master and poet, He usually recommends that we should smile a little, just a little inner smile to ourselves when we sit and meditate. Because that starts the endorphins, or whatever you call them in English, and this makes the mind more calm and happy, and tolerance and humor is really good for our inner peace and tranquility. So the next factor, the sixth factor, is samadhi, or concentration. And concentration means that the mind is focused on an object in some way. And just as light that is concentrated into a laser beam can cut through things, even steel, the concentrated mind can also penetrate very deep into the processes of life. And we can see that in the Buddha's teaching, how extremely precise he could examine body and human body and mind in a way that's still valid 2,600 years later. So this concentrated mind can observe things that an unconcentrated and wandering mind isn't able to do. But when you begin to meditate and turn your attention inward, the first thing you usually see is how uncontrollable the mental and emotional processes are. You might have thought that you would decide what to think or feel, but it turns out that we have very little control over this stream of thoughts, emotions, and reactions that constantly flow through our minds. But when the mind gets more focused and still, we can start to explore these different layers of thoughts and emotions and see how they appear and disappear in every moment. And the body that seemed really solid and sometimes very painful and so on, we can also start seeing how it consists of all these moving sensations, and we can see how everything is a process of constant change. So in this way, concentration develops wisdom and understanding of how things work and what is the true nature of things. So there are two types of concentration used in Buddhist meditation, and we have been practicing both of them, so I've just mentioned them briefly. So in the first method, we focus on one single object, for example, the breath, and as soon as the mind slips off the breath, we bring it back again. And this is to develop a more one-pointed concentration. And this can induce serenity and calm in the mind, you know. Breathing can become very light and slow, and sometimes thinking stops, maybe not completely, but almost. And the first time someone experiences this in meditation, one usually gets so surprised, because usually the mind isn't like that, and we get excited and we immediately begin to think how to hold on to this state and how great it is and so on. And that, of course, makes it disappear right away. But eventually you learn how to stay with this longer and longer, and though it usually doesn't last very long, but after a while you don't get so excited about it. It's just part of the flow of things. So in the second type of concentration, which is the insight vipassana kind, is described as moment-to-moment concentration. and the objects might vary. The mind moves between body, mind, things like body sensations, and then we hear a sound, so then that becomes the object, and then maybe there's some mental, we get lost in thoughts for a while, we come back to the breath, and then we have some emotion, or you know how the way we have described how to meditate. And usually we combine these two methods. Like at the beginning of a sitting, it's always good to start with this more one-pointed kind of concentration on the breath, for example. And then when the mind feels a little bit more stable and calm, we can broaden out our awareness to all these different objects. And concentration is also very useful in daily life, because one becomes more efficient and integrated. So it's really good. It really pays off to train this power of concentration. So then, the last and seventh factor of enlightenment is equanimity, or mental balance, means upekkha. And Greg mentioned that today also, that it's one of the Brahma Viharas, like the Metta Karuna, and Mudita means sympathetic joy, and then the last one is upekkha, which is equanimity. And the metaphor that's usually used to illustrate equanimity is a mountain. A mountain is not disturbed whether the sun is shining or it's raining or somebody's climbing up on it or it's snowing or whatever. The mountain just sits there balanced and equanimous. So equanimity means that we can meet life's ups and downs, maintaining our mental balance. Because in our lives, in all human lives, there are always situations that we can't avoid or change. There's nobody who doesn't sometime come in contact with suffering or grief, sickness, accidents, pain, old age, and death. And the question is how we can open ourselves and live with these inevitable things that will come in human life. And to become totally paralyzed or heartbroken or depressed won't do any good in the long run, even though, of course, sorrow must sometimes takes its time to heal. But in this process, we can really have a lot of good use of our meditation practice, and the equanimity that we have developed will help us to come through these difficult times in a better way. Because as equanimity develops, we learn not to be totally overwhelmed by our emotions. But it's also very important not to confuse equanimity with indifference, which is its so-called near enemy. And indifference is a mental state that on the surface can sort of look like equanimity, but in reality is quite different. Indifference means that we have turned off our emotions. We don't allow ourselves to feel or to be touched. We become emotionally numb. But equanimity develops from observation and wisdom. And to some extent it can also be a matter of maturity, even if you can't really say when a person becomes mature. It doesn't always have to do with age, you know, it can be other factors that are in play there. So vipassana, as we've said before, means insight, and by meditating we get different insights, as it's said. But in fact we already have really a lot of good insights. We know what makes us feel bad or feel good or feel happy or sad or stressed or upset. It's just that often we don't dare to believe in these insights because they seem to go on a collision course with what the rest of society is telling us about how we should be to be normal and happy. The picture that TV series and commercials and films and sometimes other culture media or so on gives of human life is really a recipe for disaster. For example, so if you see all this TV series and so on, you get the idea that you should always have, you should always be really passionately engrossed in all these life dramas. You should have many love affairs and intrigues going on, and you must also have a good job and make a lot of money and buy a variety of fashionable clothes and gadgets of different kinds, and also more seriously to sort of be counted as a conscious citizen, you must read newspapers and watch news on TV or internet. And the news are almost exclusively devoted to reporting about all the awful and terrible and depressing things that happen in the world. Very seldom you hear about the good things. So, but you shouldn't try to do anything about all this misery that you see, because if you sort of become some activist, a professional demonstrator, or maybe even a terrorist, that's not good. But maybe you can send some money to some organization that takes care of these disasters and go on sitting in your sofa in front of your TV. At least here in Scandinavia and Sweden anyway, it's also a bit suspect to be interested in religion or spirituality of some kind. It's sort of, you know, spaced out or something. But you should care very carefully about your body so it's always fit and slim and forever young. So, even if you count yourself as a reasonably aware person who doesn't get deluded by all this advertising, maybe some subconscious region of the brain or whatever it is becomes influenced anyway, because sometimes we believe in all these things and we sort of become brainwashed to some extent. And so we really have to try to see through this veil of total materialism that the society wants us to believe in so they can sell us more things. it's not that Buddhism says that you shouldn't have love affairs or nice clothes or some iPads or whatever. It's more a question of attitude, you know, to what you have. To be able to let go is the foundation of equanimity. And calm also. So if you cling to people, things, opinions, lifestyles, or all these possessions that you've gathered, of course you suffer when you lose them. That's normal. But by accepting that loss and change is as natural as gain and stability, we can live with more equanimity. So there was this Zen master who said, when my house burnt down, I got an unobstructed view of the full moon. So quite often things that seem really difficult turn out to be quite good in the end. You can get a view of the full moon. What time is it? Oh, I still have some time. So then I'm going to tell you a story. Maybe somebody has heard it before. It's been going around for a while. But anyway, I think it's a good story. So a long time ago in Japan, in these feudal times, there were these local warlords who terrorized people, the villages around. And one of these warlords, he was specially known for his cruelty and his rage. So when the inhabitants of the village heard that he and his guys were on the way, they were approaching, everybody fled up into the mountains, took all the valuables they could carry and left. Only this one person remained, and there was the Zen master in his... He stayed in the temple. And the warlords, the troops invaded the village, and the soldiers looked around and told their leader that it was empty of inhabitants, except for one monk who was sitting in the temple meditating. So this commander, warlord, he strode off to this temple and threw open the door and stood in front of the Zen master with his sword raised and shouted, "Why are you sitting here? Why haven't you not fled with all the others? Don't you know I'm a man who can cut you in half without blinking?" And the Zen master calmly met his eyes and replied, "But I'm a man who can be cut in half without blinking." So that's the ultimate equanimity, you can say. So it's said that this warlord guy, he lowered his sword, bowed and left. He couldn't do anything about such a person. So another one of the definitions of equanimity is to be close to everything. Equanimity supports compassion, acceptance, and peace of mind. But it also makes it possible to act in the world with clarity and force. It's not sort of just being a vegetable, sit around being an equanimous vegetable. You can also act from this this clarity and calm that it gives. So, and also it's to be open to see different sides of a thing, not to be fanatical in our views about anything. This provides an opportunity to resolve conflicts in a peaceful way, both in your own mind and in the society around you. So now I've talked about all the seven factors, so I just go through them very quickly. So first, mindfulness triggers and balances the other factors. And then there are the three uplifting active factors, investigation, effort, and joy. And followed by the three stabilizing factors, calm, concentration, and equanimity. And those seven factors, they develop by themselves when we practice meditation, and also when we're aware and alert in daily life. And to actually embody these qualities is to reach our full potential, actually, of being a good human being. But you can't force them. You have to let them develop in their own time. You have to be patient and just be aware of what's happening. So, but by paying attention to times when one or more factors, when they're present in the mind, that will strengthen them. Sometimes we are more aware of the unpleasant factors because we suffer more from them, and we sort of don't notice these pleasant and wholesome factors as much. So, you know, that's what Greg was saying in this morning, that we should also be aware when the difficulties are not there, because then maybe some of the enlightenment factors are there instead. Because these factors, seven factors, can help us to live in more harmony with an open heart, not totally blinded by either negative or positive emotions. So they give us more inner balance and clear mind, which enables us to act more wisely or refrain from acting. That's also sometimes necessary. And they are the key to awakening. So, let's sit for a moment.